immigrating here to America.
Yes, with my wife, we always loved the US. Before coming there, we had already visited around 20 national parks. We love nature. Yeah. And we have family too in Louisiana. So I've been many times in the past in New Orleans with these French inspirations. That's so great. I made some concerts there, and I love the enthusiasm of the public. And we moved to Texas for her job, and I'm still working a lot in France and in Europe with all the best early music ensembles. And I conduct the Ensemble Baroque de Monaco in the southeast of France, and the orchestra Classic Passion, which is symphonic, and we are performing regularly with big concerts like Beethoven symphonies, movie music concerts. And what I want to develop here, because we are a very faithful family, and we feel like Texas here is really the good place to make it. I would like to deepen the sacred music that exists since the 17th century to the 20th. There are so many incredible pieces, and here I found many musicians that are very faithful, and they are able to communicate what they believe in. Mm-hmm. And for example, contrary to France, I used to make incredible concerts, but people are less believers. And when you play with musicians that understand the meaning of the lyrics, and they are believing in what they're saying, they're singing, there is a real added value when they are singing about the death of Christ or his birth. I will tell you later about the content of this program. They are really deep and sad of his passion and crucifixion, and it's not just beautiful lyrics and beautiful notes. So with this involvement, I can tell you, for the last big concerts we had, people were really crying at the end of the concert because they share something really during the concert.
So it's almost like you can't fake it, can you? I mean, you can be a great musician, but if it's not in your heart, that kind of shows when you're singing. And I guess it just helps so much if you actually believe what you're singing and you have that love of Christ in you.
Yeah, it's more natural, I would say.
Yeah, right. I want to read a paragraph from your website. And again, LafayetteMusicians.org is the website. The concert that Matthew and the Lafayette musicians are putting on is coming up Saturday, November 2nd. It's a classical music orchestra composed of professional instrumentalists and singers created in 2022. Their name honors Marquis de la Lafayette, a French hero of the American Revolution, who was the only French person awarded honorary citizenship of the United States of America exactly 20 years ago. That's a neat little connection to France and a neat little piece of American history. What a great name. So needless to say, that's where the name came from, huh?
Exactly. Perfectly understood.
Yeah. So tell us, you have, started in 2022, so this is pretty new here in America. What have y'all done so far? And I know you did a Haydn-themed concert. You've been to Christ the King Parish in Dallas. What's the response been, and how's it going so far?
So before creating in 2022, I took many information from the musicians' background, from the area, from the public, and we really thought it was a great idea to create this dream for me to link my two passions, faith and music. And so we decided to create a non-profit organization to be also able to receive donations in the future. But first, I wanted really to show that I was not just like a French conductor coming with the background, but without proving. And so we made the first concert in 2022 with Handel and Lully on David's Psalms. This was our first great concert with 70 musicians on stage, if you can say stage, because it was in Christ the King Church in May 2022. Then we made also another concert in Dallas Aldrich House. Like this concert, the seats are limited because it's a small house with woods everywhere, all the stuff. It's a really an old museum. It's called Dallas Aldrich House Museum. And there is really a soul coming from this place. And we are adding some emotions by putting candlelights everywhere. Mm-hmm. And we are very close to the audience. So this is a really... an experience that goes very deeply inside, because the public are surrounded by the singers and you are totally inside. And then we made the Haydn creation you talked about earlier in Christ the King 2. It was more 80 musicians on stage. So it was really an incredible concert. And these three first concerts for me are really a proof of what we did. And as I told you before, I'm very severe with the quality of our performances. I'm never 100% satisfied. But I can tell you, for example, Haydn Creation is 1 hour 30 of music. And every time I pick up in all my past concerts some minutes, some moments to put on YouTube, sometimes 5, sometimes 10 minutes. For this one, I put, and you can see on our website, 45 minutes of extracts of music, which are really, really incredible. So I really wish that people come to our website to see the real quality we are providing.
Yeah, the website again, LafayetteMusicians.org, LafayetteMusicians.org. The concert Saturday, November 2nd, the Baroque Candlelight Concert. It also is going to involve hors d'oeuvres, desserts, drinks. The concert will begin at 7 o'clock with the hors d'oeuvres being served at 6 o'clock with the Lafayette Musicians. I want to read another paragraph from the website, and this has to do with this particular concert.
Yes.
It says, male voices, singers, accompanied by Baroque violins, the Thurbo luth, the gamba, and organ will play early music pieces composed by one of major French Baroque composers, Marc-Antoine Charpentier. My pronunciation.
That's
there.
Fine.
You'll hear pieces dealing with the Christ's birth and passion, from his Messe de Minute, his Meditations, an outstanding Magnificat. So these songs are really entrenched in the life of Christ, right? And that, how does that come out in the music? And how, you know, do people, when they hear the music, they're able to really kind of get into that story of Christ's life? How do you do that as a musician?
What helps is also the precious booklets we give before each concert, because they are all the translations. And this music is sung in Latin, and moreover, it's French Latin song, so it's quite hard to understand for American people. So there are in these booklets translations and explanations, and I say some words before the pieces so people can really understand them. And then it's very crystal clear as it's written. One in the middle talks about the passion of the Christ, and you understand in the way it is written that suddenly the harmony are very poor. It's about the death. And then it's about resurrection. It's very rich, very forte, very enthusiasm. And so, yes, this concert will be divided in three parts. So it starts at 7, but at 6 there is, as you told, hors d'oeuvre, desserts, French food and drinks, and wine. And from 7 to 8, not later, there will be really this concert divided in three parts. The first is about the Messe de Minuit of Charpentier, which is about the birth of Christ. Then second part is about all the Passion. It's a Lent Meditations. There are 10 of them. And at the end, the three male voices, a Magnificat for Virgin Mary, which goes with a continuo, the continuo with the organ and the cello. And that's incredible because they are playing like 100 times the four same notes.
Mm.
And on this, the composer Marc-Antoine Charpentier created many melodies. And so you're never bored by these four notes, but it's enriched by the participation of violin, the flute. There is a Baroque flute too, and the three male voices too.
Yeah.
It's really one of my preferred pieces. That's why I really wanted to make them discover in Dallas. I don't think this music is played so much, and it's really a goosehump music.
Yeah. You mentioned before we started that your musicians are very eager. They love doing this, and they, you know, when's the next concert? When's the next concert? See, I have a lot of enthusiasm. And I'm delighted to hear that there is so much local talent that you're able to, not only talent, but people of faith that want to participate in something like this. And these were people at really the highest level of musical talent, right? I mean, you got a lot of rich talent here in North Texas.
A lot. And of course, when I contacted them, I talked them about the program, but I talked to them about my my aim to share sacred music, because this music is really soul lifting. And I received really so many feedback from the musicians after the last two concerts, saying it was there was something more than in some other concerts. Maybe it was what we talked earlier with this share of our beliefs, and they really want to make others, and I'd like to, but these concerts are very expensive, and I would dream to make 3 to 4 big concerts a year. But by now it's too expensive, and we are looking for helpers and donators, I hope, in the future, since now I really think we showed we can do very high quality concerts. Yeah.
And I know you're flying back and forth quite often to France, as you mentioned, and you're working there. Would the goal be that you wouldn't have to do that as often, because you're kind of doing that a necessity, right? And you'd like to be able to just make a life here in America? Is that the long range goal?
It could be a real goal, because for me, as I told you before, if I can really share all my life, my two passions, music and faith, it would be the goal. Because in France, it's more music and less about faith, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. The Baroque period, tell us about that. And, is that a particular time in history? And also, what was the art and the music? What's the uniqueness of that particular period in time?
So it's a bigger period than what people think. It started in the 1600 and ended at the death of Bach in the 1750. And so it's 150 years where music made incredible improvements in the way to write music and the way to play it, with new instruments and new kind of voices. For example, in France, the high tenors were a lot employed. It was a new voice called haut contre. Only high tenor can sing like that. Created in Italy, it was the contrary. They started to employ a lot of castrati. You know, the kids who were taken off their virility to be able to sing high notes. So this was a profusion of new way of singing and of writing and playing music. During 150 years, the whole story of music was changed. So you can say that it started with Monteverdi, the Italian composer, and it ended with Johann Sebastian Bach, the best composer ever, in 1750. And there are thousands and thousands of sacred music to be done from this period.
Very nice. My guest is Mathieu Dumortier. He is the founder of the Lafayette Musicians. And as I mentioned at the beginning, he and his wife, Celine, their two sons, are here in North Texas. They've been here for a few years, although Mathieu is having to travel back and forth to France quite often for work purposes. They're parishioners at St. Anne Parish in Capel. The Baroque Candlelight Concert will be Saturday, November 2nd at the Dallas Aldridge House Museum. 6 o'clock hors d'oeuvres, desserts and drinks, and then a 7 o'clock performance by the Lafayette Musicians. What is the capacity there? How many tickets can you sell?
Maximum 60 tickets. By now, I would say 50 remaining, so we still have some time. But I saw last year that people are sometimes buying their tickets on the last day, which is not very convenient for the organizers, because you don't know how many programs to pre-win.
We go through all the time. You know, we just wish, would everybody just buy your tickets? If you think you're going, buy your tickets now. But it's human nature. They wait to the last second. Does this kind of music, it's conducive to liturgy, or do you ever play in mass settings?
Yes. For example, the extract we'll play for the midnight mass could be played in every midnight mass every year. The Lent meditations could be played in every Lent period, and the Magnificat for the Virgin Mary events could be played. And this, really, this concert, I had last year a couple who came for their wedding anniversary, and they found it perfect, because for the first hour they had a very refined dinner, and then they are, it's it's kind of romantic to be in the darkness only with the candlelight and hearing these voices so close to you. Not aggressive voices, very loud, like you can have in romantic time, but more intimate. And so that's really, as if you're not fond of music or you don't know so much, you will learn a lot with the booklets and you will really, really appreciate and discover a new experience.
Yeah, do you get people coming out? Are most of them like aficionados, or are these people that maybe don't have any background in classical, you know, sacred music, and there's maybe listening to it for the first time, or what is all the above? What is the level of experience typically the people who come to one of your concerts?
Yeah, it comes from all backgrounds. And we always try to make concerts not too long, because for people who don't know this music, if you make 2 hours of it, it's too much. This kind of concert is really the best path to make to discover Baroque music. And if you don't know music, Baroque music is more original, more genuine, and it will more touch you, because, for example, the instruments, the theorbal lute and the violins, are with the strings which are not in steel, but they are with the lamb intestines, I don't know how to say.
Yeah, okay.
And this sound is less aggressive, it's more hot, warmer, and intimate, and the voices, as I told you before, it's not shouting loud. It's more intimate, I would say, again.
Yeah. When people think of famous composers, you mentioned Bach, and of course Beethoven would be in that conversation, and Mozart, and maybe Vivaldi. These are mostly German. Mozart was, I think, Austrian, perhaps?
Austrian,
Then you know, also Italian. Who are the best-known French composers? Has France had a great contribution to sacred music historically?
We had so many. The most renowned in Baroque period, I don't know if that ring a bell for American people, would be Lully, Rameau, Charpentier. And then on the classic period and the romantic period, we have a bunch of like Massenet. Then 20th century, we have a lot of Debussy, Fauré. They are maybe less known than Bach and Mozart, but they are really incredible. But the problem is that in France, we are not so proud of classical music. And in Germany, in Italy, they are very proud of their Verdi, Puccini, Donizetti, Vivaldi. In Germany too, Beethoven, Schubert. But in France, it's a shame to like classical music, so they don't show it.
No, I wouldn't think that. I think the French people are being very cultured, and you would think that they would embrace it.
And did you see the opening of the Olympics? Did you see some great French composers put in the light? No, it was not beautiful music at all for me.
We all heard about that opening ceremony, didn't we?
Unfortunately.
So tell us, you know, in light of that, you know, from what you're saying, it's not something that's appreciated in the culture. What was your upbringing like, and how did you get into this? Is this something that your family was all involved in, or what? How did this spark of love of sacred music first enter you, and at what age?
I always loved and played violin music, but my dad was a director of the Conservatoire of Music of Nice for 40 years. So of course I was there in the music when I was young. And my mom was born in Poland, in Częstochowa, which is the most high religious part of the Poland. And she sang a lot of early music
in her life. So you're born right into it.
So
yeah.
I was really the melting of these two, and deeply influenced since my young age, but I am now convinced this is my goal, to make this music.
Yeah, that's going to be, like I said at the beginning, what a blessing to have you here through the providence of God. And of course, you say your wife, you know, got a job here, and here you are in North Texas. I think your wife's working as an engineer, and here you are doing this. And so, I really want to encourage people to support Matthew and the Lafayette musicians, and, the many ways they can do this. Of course, pray for you, financial support, go to the concert. LafayetteMusicians.org is the website. LafayetteMusicians.org. The concert Saturday, November 2nd, Dallas Aldridge House Museum, 6 o'clock hors d'oeuvres, desserts, drinks, 7 o'clock performance. I think you said it's going to be about an hour or so. And a Baroque candlelight concert. Sounds like a perfect, like, date or somebody else. Like, oh,
yeah,
God,
right.
Man, and can bring his wife too.
And people can see on this famous website, they have a lot of extracts of the big concerts, but there is extracts. There are extracts from the last year candlelight concerts, so mm-hmm. they can really figure out how intimate and beautiful it can be.
Yeah, and it's also getting into the holiday season and the fall, and this is just such an awesome time of year as well. So how can people support you? Is there something on the website where people can donate?
Do you want people to get
in contact with you? And anything else that you just want to say to promote this concert, encourage people listening right now to come on out to the concert? What would you tell them?
Yeah, as if they cannot come to spread the word and see our job. And I think here, really, it's the Bible Belt, but for classical music, we are the only orchestra and choir wholly dedicated to sacred music. So I hope they can spread the word around them. And maybe the more you talk, the more you have a chance to find support. And I think there are, once again, there is a lot of material on the website, videos, pictures, historic, so they can show to all their friends what we are doing.
Yeah. And do you have anything planned for 2025 yet?
Yes, I would dream to make Gabriel Fauré Requiem, which is a masterpiece, French masterpiece. And this is, for me personally, very important because this is the piece on which my parents met. So.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. Okay. You fly them over for that. Huh? are they still...
My dad, yes.
Okay. Is still... Okay, awesome. Well, Matthew, thank you for making another trip over here. It's always good to get an update on how you're doing. Matthew Desmottier, if you want to know the spelling of his last name, it's D-U and then a separate word, M-O-T-I-E-R, Matthew, M-A-T-T-H-I-E-U, Desmottier. And again, most important thing is just go to that website. All the information is there. It's a beautiful website, LafayetteMusicians.org. Baroque Candlelight Concert, Saturday, November 2nd. Dallas Aldridge House Museum, 6 o'clock hors d'oeuvres, desserts and drinks, and a 7 o'clock performance, probably be out by 8 o'clock or so. Yes.
Yes, and if I can add a last thing, because he was very convinced of the quality of the concert and our way to put this music, sacred music on, Bishop Kelly came for our last concert, he introduced it, and he accepted to be our honor president, so that gives more value to our...
Oh, he's a president of your group.
Yeah,
organization.
The president of the organization.
Wow. Well, that's awesome. Congratulations on that.
That's going to help.
Yeah, it certainly is. Certainly is. Well, thanks, Bishop Kelly, for that. And I bet Bishop Burns would really appreciate coming to one of these concerts as well. He's a great man. All right. Well, thanks so much. We're out of time. Thanks to Cecil for running the board. Thank you for listening and supporting all the great things that are happening, because everything needs our support, prayerful, financial, and also, you know, being there present for a concert like this. LafayetteMusicians.org is the website. LafayetteMusicians.org. This is the North Texas Interview of the Week here on the Guadalupe Radio Network. God bless you. Thank you for listening.
Registration is open for the 26th annual White Rose Golf Classic. The White Rose Golf Classic will take place Friday, October 25th at Fire Wheel Golf Course in Garland. Proceeds benefit the White Rose Center in their mission of saving lives and caring for pregnant women in crisis. The four-person scramble shotgun start begins at 11 a.m. with an awards dinner to follow. Visit the St. Paul Men's Club website at stpaulmc.org to register.
Hi, my name is Gabriel Garrison. I'm currently studying at the University of Dallas, and I'm a former student of Homeschool Connections, a Catholic online provider of live and recorded classes for grade school, middle school, and high school students. At Homeschool Connections, your student can learn from teachers with high levels of experience in their fields. You can learn more by visiting homeschoolconnections.com, a sponsor of the GRN. That's homeschoolconnections.com.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to this edition of the North Texas Interview of the Week here on the Guadalupe Radio Network. I hope you are having a fine weekend. And in this program, we like to highlight folks in the local community that are helping to build up the body of Christ. And I have always enjoyed learning from people who come into the studio about ventures that they're doing and just good things. And this is definitely going to be the case over these next 25 minutes. I'm going to introduce you to a married couple from the Fort Worth Diocese in the Denton area who are supporters of this station of the Guadalupe Radio Network. And they also have an amazing ambitious and beautiful project underway. It's called Community Forever Village, and it's a development of the 1877 journey, as they will explain what that's all about. You can find them online at communityforever.org, communityforever.org, and it would take me a long time to kind of explain what this is all about, but I will read you a little bit and tell you, first of all, they're Pete and Gretchen Maugens are their names. They're a married couple. And Pete is the founder and CEO of Community Forever Village. He is a serial entrepreneur. He's been starting businesses since he literally was 14 years old. Gretchen is an attorney and has been an attorney for many decades. And they've been married since 2011. And so let me just read a little bit before we formally bring them into the conversation. They said they are here to cultivate community by empowering everyone into a life of belonging and dignity. The Community Forever Village intends to provide permanent, alternative, supportive housing in a manner that fosters community for our chronically homeless neighbors. And that's the basics. And so I'm going to bring primarily Pete into the conversation. And of course, Gretchen may jump in as well as she feels so inspired. But thanks to both of you for coming in and spending some time with me. And I'm really excited to share this vision and project with our listeners. So thanks, Pete, for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having us. We're glad to be here.
Yeah, so how I look at, you know, you've got designs in front of us and pictures of this big project, which I know is all pretty much still in the future, but can you kind of take us back to the origin of how this started? How did this vision first come into your mind? Yeah. Tell us that story.
Well, so my wife and I both have a mutual friend by the name of Brian that sits on the board of Mobile Loaves and Fishes out of Austin, Texas, which is a food truck ministry. They've been around for over 25 years. And about 10 years ago, they started a village down there called Community First Village to serve the formerly chronically homeless, to bring people into a place of permanence, put them in permanent housing in a supportive environment. And so we've known Brian for a long time. Brian's been on their board for a long time. And so we've known of this concept. And my wife has an individual that had some property they wanted to donate for a good cause, mm-hmm. and kind of stated it in that manner. I want to do something good with this. And it's over 70 acres of land. And so because we knew Alan Graham, who started Community First, and through Brian, we had the opportunity to introduce this lady to Alan Graham, get a tour of Community First, and she decided that she wanted that concept to happen on her property in Denton, Texas. And so that was over 3 years ago, and at the time, that's kind of a Reader's Digest version of how it happened. But at the time, I agreed. We went to Austin. We went with her to Austin, and when she made this comment, I agreed to volunteer to kind of spearhead a search committee to find the leadership team to do this, because we've known Brian all this time. We know of Community First. It's not something I've ever done, but as a serial entrepreneur, I keep doing the next thing that I've never done. And I have done a little bit of development. We own a development right now that we own and operate. So I jumped in there because we had a very generous, you know, person that wanted to give land for a good cause and for this specific cause. And then we knew of the people in Austin that knew how to do it. And I look at Denton as a, you know, a community that embraces these type things. And so I decided to jump in to try and just coordinate things to try and get some motion for this and then try to find the leadership to take it over and build it. That was my original intention.
Yeah.
You know, as it's turned out, we decided to form the organization. So I became the founder and chair of the organization. Yeah. And, you know, we've submitted permits with the city for a planned development. And we've hired our first employee, and we're We've hired, you know, consultants. We've got our financial management together and, you know, and all these kind of things and website up and all these different, you know, things that you would need to do in the startup process we've been undertaking for the last 3 years. And so, you know, here we sit. Now we've got a permit in with the city of Denton and hopeful to be approved, you know, before too long on that and start construction.
Yeah. The first, there's so many curiosity questions that pop into my mind when I think of this. And I guess the first one from a practical standpoint is I think, how in the world are you going to pay for this? Because you're housing homeless people. They're not going to pay for it. But where does the money come from for something like this?
Yeah, well, if you ask, and I've been going to school on the homelessness issue in the United States over the past 3 years, and I've interviewed a lot of leaders in the space all over the country, in different states, and it comes from the private sector, it comes from donors, it comes from hearts that are touched that want to do something good, and we look at ourselves as a ministry, and we believe that you know, healing from the ravages of homelessness includes, you know, not only life-saving measures, pulling someone out of danger, immediate danger, but then life-sustaining, keeping a roof over their head and helping them in some support capacity there. But then also life growth, you know, giving them opportunities to learn and develop job opportunities or training opportunities and that kind of thing. But where we want to go is in life transformation, and that's on the spiritual side where we know people need spiritual renewal. And so we want to leave the door open for that. And so what makes this opportunity different than a lot that you may have seen in the homelessness space, and this is what made Community First so unique, was they bring in what they call missionals, which are volunteers to live in the neighborhood alongside the formerly chronically homeless in a ministry capacity, develop relationships with those individuals. So these are volunteers that would live in the village. They may work outside the village. You know, these are not people that are staff members that come. They're really missionaries.
Mm-hmm.
So and Community First has them from other states far away. But so we want to develop it. Alan Graham says that the single greatest cause of homelessness in the United States is the catastrophic destruction of the family
unit. Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, without the undergirding support of family, these folks that have fallen into chronic homelessness, their you know, their future prospects are not good if they don't get some real tangible help.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want to build a village. We want to construct a village, but our real vision is to build a community, you know, so that there's heart-to-heart and human-to-human connection where real healing and ministry can take place. And, you know, we know that these folks that are suffering need the love of Christ. And whether they have been a part of a church family or not, we want the space to be such that it's inviting for that purpose as well. But in the beginning, it's love thy neighbor through the actions. You know, this is the way that I think God calls us to love other people, to be non-judgmental, you know, to be open and to not be arrogant and boastful about what we're doing, but to be graceful in what we're doing and, you know, help these people through their process, but helping them reclaim their dignity is also giving them opportunity to have, you know, to have some skin in the game. So, you know, they have to pay some rent and these kind of things. So there's elements to it that are different than a lot of homelessness initiatives you may have seen out there.
Mm-hmm. What's the timeline?
So we started a little over 3 years ago with the idea, and then we just recently in June of this year got to the point where we were able to submit our plan development permit application, and we're working through that with the city right now. We're hopeful that we can get through that process here in the next few months. And then we'll enter into, as soon as we have that approval, we'll enter into a civil engineering phase and permitting phase for the actual structures that are going to go on the ground. And so all that adds up to, I'm scared to death to give you a date.
I won't hold you to it, I promise.
Yeah, I know. Everybody says that, you know. But we're certainly hopeful within 18 months we'll be able to house people, if not sooner.
Oh, really? Wow.
But, you know, that's an ambitious timeline. Mm-hmm. I'm being told that I'm too ambitious with that, but we're we're on the march. And so your original question, now backing up, so how's this going to be paid for? Well, our very generous benefactor also donated an additional tract of land that's over 200 acres. Mm. And so we've now got, for the entire project, 250 or so acres. My wife's laughing because she knows I wander down these rabbit holes. I told you I was going to be like this. I get off topic. And so we're in the process right now of looking at, you know, should we use some of the land that we've got as a funding mechanism? Mm. And if so, how do we do that in these kind of things? So we're talking to some of those in the community that are business people, that, you know, the development arena and these kind of things, that have a heart for our mission. And we would invite some of those, from some others of those, to come forward. But, you know, should we do some ground leases or some land liquidation or some strategic alliances with local businesses in this to create some funding? But primarily, we're gonna need to create the fundraising apparatus and get that machine going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there something else I missed, Gretchen, yes, that you'd like to?
What I would mention is that we do plan, when you mentioned that there's going to be rent required to be paid, minimal rent,
uh-huh,
but part of the process of helping these people heal is helping them to obtain dignified income.
Yeah.
And so what they do in Austin is that they might have people doing landscaping, cleaning, you know, various of the public places, and paying them a dignified income.
Yeah.
So out of that helps them reclaim their dignity.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's part of what it is, but it does operate at a deficit in Austin. We anticipate that we would also.
So. Yeah. And so once you say perhaps as soon as 18 months from now that you could be housing some of these folks, how do you find who lives there and how do they qualify? Because I'm imagining homelessness is on a spectrum where some people, yeah, just, you know, missed a couple of rents and they're out, you know, down and out, as opposed to somebody who's just on death's door and lying under a bridge and downtown. So there's a broad spectrum. Who qualifies?
Well, there's case management. There's case management that takes place out there. And so we'll need to collaborate with local organizations that are operating in the space, whether it be shelters, and, you know, there are organizations in Denton that are going out with outreach programs and meeting individuals and then providing services, and through services, you know, they're able to attain information about who's in genuine need of help and how to help them. And so there's a whole process we bring them through with that. We're working through the specifics right now and a lot of details. We've hired our first employee, and Senior Vice President of Operational Development, Shirley Kruger. She's in Austin right now, embedded in their operations right now to learn all these kind of things. But the identification of someone that we would look to onboard into the village will come through other organizations and, you know, a collaborative effort there with their tracking and interviewing. I think that will be the primary beginning place where we start interviewing someone to bring aboard. So it's not like a, you know, normal for-profit affordable housing complex or apartment complex where you just open the doors and say, hey, we're open for business, come sign up. There is a methodical process, and we're going to focus on those that are in genuine need, that are in Denton County, that have been chronically homeless in Denton County. You know, that means they've been on the streets of Denton County for at least 12 months. They typically have a disabling condition. They're a single unaccompanied male or female, so those definitions all go in there. But we're learning all those things that we need to do a proper onboarding of those, mm-hmm, who need help.
You know, in reading y'all's bios, I see that you've been working in, you know, helping the underprivileged in other capacities. And I, if you don't mind, Gretchen, I wanted to ask you about one connection that you had, the former Monsignor King Outreach Center. And I ask about that because I remember in the early days of Catholic Radio, I think I told you about this on the phone, I met Monsignor King. And I just would like to tell that story because it's a beautiful story. Of course, God rest his soul, he's no longer with us. But he was an inspiration to you, wasn't he? And I know there are probably some people listening in the Denton area that have fond memories of him. Can you tell us, our listeners, the connection between Monsignor King and what you and Pete are doing now?
Sure. So Monsignor King, I was fortunate to be his finance chair for, or co-chair, de facto chair for nearly 10 years, and developed a close relationship with him. And toward the end of my tenure and toward the end of his life, he came to realize that there were, it was 16 degrees outside and there were people that had nowhere to go. And so he learned that, was appalled and shocked, and opened the doors of the church, for our beautiful new church at that time on Bonnie Brae, to let them come in from the cold. And that morphed into having cots set up in the narthex. Of course, a lot of people were very concerned in the beginning about that we were right next to a school and what if these people steal from us. But he said it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And so he just decided to do that. We got behind it. One of his homilies even before then that has stuck with me, I think I mentioned to you for a long time, is that he said he was driving to Dallas, saw a homeless person on the side of the road with a sign. And, you know, he said, you know, at first I was inclined to drive by him, you know, and then I realized, what if that's Jesus?
Yeah.
And that has stuck with me for all these years.
Mm-hmm.
So after he passed, Roy Metzler was spearheaded an effort to turn what was then the animal shelter in Denton into a homeless shelter, which was it became almost 100 beds, and it was very successful. It was run only during inclement weather at the beginning. If it was over 100 degrees or below 32 degrees, they would open the shelter. Then it was open three nights. And so now it has morphed into Our Daily Bread, which was where the same people we served were people that went to get their food provided to them at lunch, and Our Daily Bread provided the meals that we served at the shelter. I became part of that board, the MKOC board, and was actually on the board when it merged with ODB and did some of the legal work with that. But that was an inspiration for, you know, that was part of the formation of the inspiration of where this has come to.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate you going, bringing us down memory road and that wonderful former pastor there in Denton. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking to Pete and Gretchen Moggins. They are founder and CEO in Pete's case, and a board member in Gretchen's case, of a community forever village that is in the embryonic stage right now and is going to be on 70 acres of land in Denton, Texas. The website communityforever.org is where you can find out more information, providing permanent, alternative, supportive housing in a manner that fosters community for chronically homeless neighbors. And Pete, I wanted to ask you about the development of the 1877 journey. I mentioned that at the beginning. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? The 1877 journey?
Well, the 1877 journey. So the story started really with a guy by the name of Hermann Bartold that came across. He was a German immigrant that came all the way across the United States looking for, you know, opportunity freedom, and ended up in Texas and started buying land in Texas in 1877. And so that was kind of the family thing that happened in 1877. And then this land is being donated to us. And so just out of curiosity, I started Googling around at what happened in 1877 and what we're thinking about doing, you know, and helping people that are struggling and living on the streets. And it's really interesting what happened in 1877. So it was, you know, we'd been through the Civil War. This was the end of Reconstruction. It was a very divided time in our country. There was the Long Depression. So there was, you know, the economy was really suffering bad. And then the presidential election of 1876 was the most contested presidential election in the history of the country. It wasn't decided until 1877 through Congress with the 1877.
That was happening back then too.
Yeah, the 1877 compromise. And then I started reading about organizations that were coming to the forefront. You know, you had the Industrial Revolution and industrial age there. And so there were, with the Depression and a lot of, you know, advent of machinery and all these kind of things, there were on-the-job injuries and inner cities were struggling, and there was a break in society that started what they called the beggar class. These were homeless people. And the article that I've read about it stated that one of the biggest causes of the beggar class was the breakdown in community. So anyway, all that told, and there's a lot of stuff that came out of an organization that started in 1877 that kind of started case management to keep people from gaming the system in the homelessness space when you have philanthropic organizations step in. And so that was kind of born out of 1877. So I just thought, hey, you know what? This journey started in 1877, and so we all talked about it, and we just said it's a journey. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to ask those to join us on the journey, and it started. The family that came here lived in a tent when they started, and I just think there's something too. We're helping folks out of a tent into a place of permanence, and then, you know, modeling after Community First, we had to come up with a name for the village, and I think Community Forever just fits.
Yeah, it certainly does. Perfectly. I want to, in the time remaining, we only have a few minutes remaining, you said something before we started recording that really touched my heart. You talked about the plight of the homeless if something like Community Forever Village doesn't exist, and how these people live and die, and sometimes in horrible circumstances and wretched circumstances, and what this is saving those people from is it's a dire difference between, you know, the way they might live and die as opposed to something like this, which will provide them dignity. Can you share that with our listeners? And just, you know, with an eye on the clock here, I got about 3 minutes remaining.
Okay. I don't know if I can do anything in 3 minutes. But, yeah, what I've come to learn, I was one of those guys, honestly, that I would see them on the street corner and just look the other way. And I thought, these people just need to pick themselves up by their bootstraps, go get a job, it's the greatest country in America and all that. And what I found out is that the chronically homeless, and I'm not an expert in homelessness. I've been involved in this space for 3.5 years, you know, working hard to try and do something good. But, you know, how someone ends up homeless, I don't want to have that debate because I'm a novice and I'm a freshman on campus. Mm-hmm. But when they've been homeless, what I've come to learn for a period of time, the trauma they have experienced when they become chronically homeless is so defeating, and they're so damaged at that point, they can possibly have diminished cognitive abilities. They don't know how to set up a bank account, take care of themselves. They wouldn't know how to pay rent, set a budget, and all these kind of things. So without real help, their future prospects are literally being alone, suffering physically under a bridge or in a field and dying in that manner alone. Mm-hmm. If we don't help them. And, you know, as a God-fearing Texan, I wouldn't drive by a wounded animal and leave them if I had the ability to help them. And that's how I began to look at this. So we have the opportunity to help those people out of that situation where they can be in a space that's their own, that embodies them, that take them out of that place of danger where they can live with some dignity, and then and it's permanent. So at Community First, there's been plenty of them that live in dignity and then end up dying in dignity there as well.
CommunityForever.org is the website. Pete and Gretchen Maugens, in the time remaining, how can people who are listening right now help? What can they do? You know, this is a big venture. It's really kind of the starting point.
Yeah.
Visit that website. And what are your needs right now?
Well, everybody needs money, so I can say that. But we need volunteers to hop in. And, you know, we've been out there renovating, doing some demo on some of the property so that we could do renovation. We have property upkeep that we need. And then my wife is – oh, prayer, yes. Yeah, we definitely – we can use all the prayer that we can get. But I would like to see the business community – I'm a business owner, been a business owner forever. And I'd like to see the business community come forward and say, hey, how can we – collaborate with gifts in kind, you know, whether it's of time, of labor, of their treasure, of ideas that they have that they can bring to the table, because they're.
Thanks for listening to KATH 910 AM Frisco Dallas Fort Worth on the Guadalupe Radio Network in North Texas. Catholic radio for your soul. Heard also at grnonline.com and on your smartphone.